Welcome to Radio Occupy.
I'm Dan from London LSX.
And I'm Corey from OWS.
And we're here in the tech tent bringing you Radio Occupy.
All right, well, today's topic, we're gonna take off on just a few items. We're gonna talk about the direction of the Occupy and how we see it going from this point. We're going to go off on maybe just to kind of give you an idea about evictions from different parks. We're going to probably try to talk about some of the church's point of views. Again, we're at St. Paul's location in London, so it might be kind of fair that we give you a bit of like the church's point of views. And then, Dan, what else? What was that clip we were going to put on?
We're also going to be hearing from Arundhati Roy, who wrote God of Small Things. She did a lecture or a talk in New York and did and gave a fantastic speech, which we'll be playing some of that. It's 22 minutes long, so we're going to have to cut it down slightly to size to make it fit into the half an hour. But you can actually find that talk as well on YouTube.
All right, and so as we're going forward, just want to take a time here to throw out our email address. So if you want to send us any comments, say you like us, find out where to follow us, or just get in general contact. And that email address,
Is radiooccupy@hotmail.com.
again, that's radiooccupy@hotmail.com.
So, we've got a song which we just want to play to you by Cat Stevens called Wind.
All right, we'll start off with Cat Stevens' Win. Here it goes.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once. No, never, never, never. Listen to my words, but they fall far below. I let my music take me where my heart wants to go. I've swam upon the devil's lake, but never, 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 never. I'll never make the same mistake. No, never, never, never.
And that was Cat Stevens' Wind, one of my favorite songs.
Yeah, you know, again, one of those ones that I'm hearing for the first time, but you know, a pretty good tune overall.
And I think it kind of covers kind of one of the things which attracts people to the Occupy movement, the inertia that people feel like deep within themselves to actually do something right now. And like, what's inspired you to go to Occupy?
Well, actually, it was just out of curiosity. I found out about it while traveling, and it actually just sounded exactly what I just kind of fit into what would be my general ideas or points of view on when I look about like free speech, the protecting the human rights, and just getting a general awareness out to the public.
So, what type of stuff are we kind of? I mean, I know this. I'm just asking rhetorically. Are we trying to kind of get out there? What would you say are some of the main messages of Occupy?
Well, I don't want to speak on any messages of Occupy. What'll happen is people will be like, oh, well, this person said this. And so, but just from my own point of view, some of the ideas that I feel that should be made aware is, I always say it and I stick with it, is there's a system that's generally broken right now, and enough people are not asking enough questions about that system. Enough people are probably not even aware that the systems are not working for them. And one of the things that I stand for on the forefront is just making them aware of some things that are obvious. Whether you take education, whether you take any number of things, the banking crisis, housing crisis, if you just want to go and look around, just do a general Google search on just a few key topics, and you'll start pulling up information. But how about yourself, Dan?
Well, I did a lot of research before coming, not with the intention of actually utilizing that research in this manner. I think having explored so many topics and areas like within my writing and stuff like that, actually having it manifest in reality was too good an opportunity to miss. And we can write about it in fiction, we can write about it in papers, but very rarely does the opportunity come where people who are not necessarily financial powers or what have you get to have an impact on the state of the world and how we create a better future. Whereas we're absolutely pivotal and key to doing that because we are the creators of that future.
Exactly. And and it really is about the future. We get asked the question all the time, well, why are you guys doing this? What do you hope to see come out of this? And it really goes down to the future. Is anything going to turn or change for the better, or have any of us really satisfied as immediately as the next hour or tomorrow? Probably not. Some of us can take small victories in knowing that we are showing people a different light, having people starting to come up and ask questions. I get a small victory each time someone is it's made aware to me that someone was who was not thinking about something before is now possibly thinking about something new and asking questions amongst their friends, their job, whatever the case may be.
And I think what's key is that you don't take any one person's word for it. It's that you go and you search yourself. So it's about actually exploring yourself, becoming a professional reference point
Exactly.
and yourself.
Very
So
good.
that we can actually talk about these things and learn to articulate clearly what it is that is going on. I mean, if we look at the various systems and relationships, if we know understand what those relationships here are, we can see how we are contributing to that, which is the overall reality of what is, and we can actually do things and act in a way which can produce remedy for those situations.
Okay.
So,
What?
I think this would be a good time now to bring on George Carlin. He's got a few words on God.
God.
Joe Pesci. Two reasons. First of all, I think he's a good actor, okay? To me, that counts. Second, he looks like a guy who can get things done. Joe Pesci doesn't fuck around. Doesn't fuck around. In fact, Joe Pesci came through on a couple of things that God was having trouble with. For years, I asked God to do something about my noisy neighbor with the barking dog. Joe Pesci straightened that cocksucker out with one visit. It's amazing what you can accomplish with a simple baseball bat. So I've been praying to Joe for about a year now. And I noticed something. I noticed that all the prayers I used to offer to God and all the prayers I now offer to Joe Pesci are being answered at about the same 50% rate. Half the time I get what I want, half the time I don't. Same as God, 50-50. Same as the four-leaf clover and the horseshoe, the wishing well and the rabbit's foot. Same as the mojo man. Same as the voodoo lady who tells you your fortune by squeezing the goat's testicles. It's all the same, 50-50. So just pick your superstition, sit back, make a wish, and enjoy yourself. And for those of you who look to the Bible for moral lessons and literary qualities, I might suggest a couple of other stories for you. You might want to look at The Three Little Pigs. That's a good one. Has a nice, happy ending. I'm sure you'll like that. Then there's Little Red Riding Hood, although it does have that X-rated part where the big bad wolf actually eats the grandmother, which I didn't care for, by the way. And finally, I've often always drawn a great deal of moral comfort from Humpty Dumpty. The part I like the best, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's because there is no Humpty Dumpty and there is no God. None, not one, no God, never was. In fact, I'm gonna put it this way. If there is a God, may he strike this audience dead. See, nothing happened. Nothing happened. Everybody's okay. All right, tell you what. I'll raise the stakes a little bit. If there is a God, may he strike me dead. See, nothing happened. Oh, wait, got a little cramp in my leg. And my balls hurt. Plus, I'm blind. Oh, now I'm okay again. Must have been Joe Pesci, huh? God bless Joe Pesci. Thank you all very much. Joe bless you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Loads of money.
Yeah, God does seem to need loads of money.
And you know, and it really just goes and starts to say about some of the histories of different churches and different religions. And you know, I once saw it that the word church actually was kind of like from an old Scottish word, kirk, meaning like enterprise, or you know, leading right up into banking.
Well, here in this country, the Church of England is, I could be wrong here, but what I've heard is they're the second biggest landowner in this country. And so they have a massive, massive influence. In the St. Paul's Cathedral, on their board of trustees, are CEOs of banks and corporations. So it's kind of a, and it's also an important thing to recognize with in relation to Occupy is that there is always that pressure in order to form the structure of a corporation in order to survive in this world and get your word out. And one thing, as I'm speaking for myself, not for Occupy, I would say is that we've got to resist that temptation.
Absolutely.
Because buyer's living is enough. We don't need verification. We don't need people to go, oh, we give you a stamp, a seal of approval. We are here. We're not asking for permission. What we're trying to ask and get to the bottom of is how things work and why they work that way and why we are allowing many people to suffer so that we can sustain that way of living.
Now, you know, like you were speaking about approval and everything, that is really one point that, like, the church really seems to bank on, that you receive the approval of outside force beyond yourself. From a point that I take, my personal view again, is I go with, like, the power of me. The power of me says that, you know, I am me. Like, in any situation, I'm blessed with my own point of view. Does that mean that their power is higher than I am? Probably. Maybe not. But the point is like, I know that I'm going to be responsible for anything that I do and anything that I understand and how I project it out.
And I think that responsibility that you're talking about is absolutely key. It's about recognizing your own power. And that comes down to our learning. We don't need to have a degree or any stamps or seals of approval to learn. We are constantly learning. Our brains don't stop. You know, we don't. There aren't these convenient categorizations as we seem to intellectualize.
Right.
It's just a constant. It's life. And we learn from that. And so it kind of broadens and allows you to see behind some of the rhetorics and the wordplay of certain institutions, especially when it comes to the press, you know, advertising, and all forms of ideological sources.
Exactly.
Including Occupy itself, you know.
Yeah. There almost comes... It seems like there is a point in Occupy where it becomes like, well, what it means to be an occupier. Some people, you know, like, I'm sure all the occupations out there and in your camp, you have those group of people who really bank on the idea, well, I was one of the very first occupiers. Great. That is absolutely fantastic. I don't want to take anything away from you. But that does not give you any more power or any more of a say-so or put you any more than any other occupier who may have showed up after you. That this is, again, a horizontal movement. And what that means is that we're all equal. Each one of us has just as strong of a voice as the next person.
And kind of going along those similar train of thought, which is escaping me right now. what is very important is to recognize that just because someone doesn't necessarily conform to a label is that they're not doing work for the greater good. There are a lot of people and friends who have expressed their guilt at not kind of necessarily joining in with this. Even though at heart of what it's trying to raise is something which is close to their heart as well. But we all do things in many ways. There's a vast spectrum of action. And there are going to be times, though, when we're going to have to stand together and we're going to have to not give our consent to certain actions and consent to big actions, which enables a shift in human activity and relationship, which is more positive, which is progressive, which is peaceful. And that's one thing which I think Occupy has the power to do. So we're going to talk a little bit about the church. We kind of glossed over that in terms of... So some of the churches in New York have been quite accommodating for Wall Street, haven't they?
Well, you know, yes and no. I do want to make sure that we are mentioning how grateful we were when we were evicted from our park, that there was quite a few churches throughout New York that did open up their doors for occupiers to go and to lay their hands at night, because we didn't have that camp, so to speak, again, anymore. And so we're very grateful for that. Though, we did end up in kind of like in the middle of a few churches' political battles because, well, they are representing one side of the church war, and some of the others that were helping us may have been representing another side of the church war. And just like overall, you know, like that was, for me myself, I'm not pro-church at all. And so it was really quite weird even just to have that interaction, period.
Well, I find that the church as an institution, as a corporation, is often at loggerheads with the actual teaching. And it's something which I think many good people who join the church also struggle with. And it's actually caused quite a big divide in opinion at St. Paul's and across the church more broadly. And it's absolutely fascinating that having people from the public with no stated political affiliation or what have you has allowed for those voices to get heard. And we're given each other courage to actually stand by our conviction, and I think that can only snowball and get stronger. So that's great. I mean, we found, like with St. Paul's, that they've played quite a duplicitous role within the kind of how things are played out here at St. Paul's. On one hand, they're saying we don't want violent eviction. Then on the other hand, they're sending someone to give evidence against us in the court. So they've not put their name to the eviction case, but they've certainly put evidence to it.
Or supporting it.
Yeah, and they've supported it. So it's quite hard to understand, or it's quite hard to trust.
Yeah.
The institution, but the institution survived for so long because it has built up relationships with other powerful groups of people, and they've got relationships which have lasted for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So that's also something important to recognize.
And so, you know, yes, they have that. The church has definitely been like one of the staples of most societies. You know, it's brought communities together, it's brought communities apart.
I mean, it's also been a prerequisite for violence as well.
Exactly.
This is my God-given right.
Exactly.
I'm fighting for God's will, you know, and you see that all over the world.
Exactly, you know, whether that's church, synagogues, mosque, whatever, it's just this organized institution that really just kind of, honestly, it rubs me the wrong way.
I think it's also worth pointing out, to do with St. Paul's here, we've got a team that liaises with,
oh, really?
The cathedral.
Okay.
Yeah, and they've put a deal on the table, which not everybody's totally happy with. Some people believe that it's something that we should take them up on, and it's still in negotiations to find out what the final points are.
No,
negotiations.
Are the liaisons putting a deal on the table for the church, or the church is putting a deal on the table for
It's the church that's put negotiating with. Well, we're both negotiating, but they're putting a proposal forward.
Interesting.
Towards
like
us.
What kind of stuff are they throwing out there?
Well, they're throwing out at us having a tent at St. Paul's, a very much reduced camp, so that we still have a physical presence here for us to continue doing our GAs on the steps of St. Paul's and the like.
So they want to be behind, kind of hand-picking who can actually sit out there. And then I imagine they're going to want to eventually throw in some of their literature, and pretty soon, you know, Occupy will be used by St. Paul's to advertise for them. Is that what they expect?
It's a PR battle. It's a public relations battle, and everybody wants to be seen to be reasonable, even though some actions may contradict that very thing. So it's quite a complex kind of relationship, and then it's really hard to know what people's true intentions are, because
sure,
we have our individual intentions and desires, and then we have the party line, as it were, you know, the corporate or the institutional intentions and desires, and they don't always line up. So there are some very good people, and there are also people who wish to see the end of this. They don't want it in their yard. So next up, we're going to have what have we got next? Arundhati Roy.
Oh, yeah. And that talk, was that at What was the name of that university she was at? Where was she?
Should we find that out?
We definitely will be posting that somewhere. Or we'll have that information for you later. But the talk is good either way. It's something that you should listen to. Arundhati Roy was speaking at Washington Square Park in New York City.
I'm glad we could clear that one up anyway.
And if you want to find more of these podcasts or just find out general news from the Occupy movement, you can always check out OccupyWallStreet.org.
And then there's OccupyLSX.org.
And then we always post on WhenEMW.org.
When East Meets West. Also, there's a new Occupy Facebook site called Occupy. It's spelled OccupyII.org, and you can start to communicate with other people who wish to form groups, research groups, working groups, and just generally have a social all year.
And this is Arundhati Roy.
What you have achieved since September 17th.
What you have achieved since September 17th.
When the Occupy movement began in the U.S.
When the Occupy movement began in the U.S.
Is to introduce a new imagination. A new political language.
A new political language.
Into the heart of empire.
Into the heart of empire. You have reintroduced
the right to dream.
The right to dream.
In a system that tried to turn everybody into zombies.
In a system that tried to turn everybody into zombies.
Mesmerized into equating mindless consumerism.
Mesmerized into equating mindless consumerism.
With happiness and fulfillment.
With happiness and fulfillment. As a writer, let me tell you.
This is an immense achievement.
This is an immense achievement.
And I cannot thank you enough.
And I cannot thank you enough.
We were talking about justice.
We were talking about justice. Today, as we speak,
the Army of the United States.
The Army of the United States.
Waging a war of occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Is waging a war of occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan.
U.S. drones are killing civilians in Pakistan and beyond.
U.S. drones are killing civilians in Pakistan and beyond.
Tens of thousands of U.S. troops and death squads.
Tens of thousands of U.S. troops and death squads. Are moving into Africa. If spending trillions of dollars of your money
to administer occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan
is not enough.
A war against Iran is being talked up.
A war against Iran is being talked up. Ever since the Great Depression. The manufacture of weapons.
And the export of war.
And the export of war. Have been key ways in which the United States.
Has stimulated its economy.
Just recently. Under President Obama,
the U.S. made a $60 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia.
A $60 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia. Moderate Muslims, right?
It hopes to sell thousands of bunker busters to the UAE.
It hopes to sell thousands of bunker busters to the UAE.
$5 billion worth of military aircraft to my country.
It has sold $5 billion worth of military aircraft to my country.
India. Which has more poor people than all the poorest countries of Africa put together.
Which has more poor people than all the poorest countries of Africa put together.
All these wars,
from the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
to Vietnam, Korea, and Latin America,
have claimed millions of lives.
All of them fought. To secure the American way of life. Today we know.
That the American way of life.
The model that the rest of the world is meant to aspire toward.
Has resulted.
In 400 people.
Owning the wealth.
Of half the population of the United States. It has meant thousands of people being turned out of their homes.
And their jobs.
While the U.S. government bailed out banks and corporations. American International Group, AIG,
alone,
was given
$182 billion.
The Indian government worships U.S. economic policy. As a result,
of 20 years of the free market economy.
Today, 100 of India's richest people
own assets worth a quarter of the country's GDP.
While more than 80% of the people
live on less than 50 cents a day.
250,000 farmers.
Driven into a spiral of debt.
Have committed suicide.
We call this progress.
And now think of ourselves as a superpower.
Like you, we are well qualified.
We have nuclear bombs.
And obscene inequality.
The good news is
that people have had enough.
And are not going to take it anymore.
The Occupy movement.
Has joined thousands of other resistance movements
all over the world.
In which the poorest of people
are standing up
and stopping the richest corporations
in their tracks.
Few of us dream.
That we would see you,
the people of the United States,
on our side,
trying to do this,
in the heart of empire.
I don't know how to communicate.
The enormity of what this means.
They, the 1%.
Say that we don't have demands.
Perhaps they don't know.
That our anger alone.
That,
that our anger alone
would be enough to destroy them. But here are some things. A few pre-revolutionary thoughts I had. For us to think about together. We want to put a lid on this system that manufactures inequality. We want to put a cap on the unfettered accumulation of wealth and property. By individuals as well as corporations. As capitalists and Luddites. We demand. An end to cross ownership in businesses. For example. Weapons manufacturers cannot own TV stations.
Mining corporations cannot run newspapers.
Business houses cannot fund universities. Drug companies cannot control public health funds. Two. Natural resources and essential infrastructure. Water supply, electricity, health, and education. Cannot be privatized. Three. Everybody must have the right to shelter, education, and healthcare. Four. The children of the rich cannot inherit their parents' wealth. This struggle has reawakened our imagination. Somewhere along the way, capitalism reduced the idea of justice to mean just human rights. And the idea of dreaming of equality.
Became blasphemous.
We are not fighting. To just tinker. With reforming. A system that needs to be replaced. As a capist and a Luddite. I salute your struggle. Salam and Zindabad. Yes. See, because often, especially now in India, when there are armed struggles and violent struggles, when you phrase something by saying violence and non-violence, it becomes a way of derailing the argument. So what we're talking about is non-violent resistance and armed resistance. Because violence and non-violence can be, you the white beacon. Now, I recently spent a long time in the forests of central India with armed guerrillas who are fighting to keep the corporations off the lands of indigenous people. To put it simply, I would say that nonviolence is a resistance strategy which is extremely effective when it has an audience, when it has an audience that is sympathetic. And for example, here in America, you have an audience. You have, because you live on television. It's important to understand that. Whereas deep inside the forests of India, when 1,000 paramilitary policemen go and burn down a village and rape the women and chase the people off, they don't have an audience. They don't have, they're too hungry to be on a hunger strike. So to me, the use of arms or nonviolence is not always an ideological thing. It's a tactical thing. And people have to understand and study very carefully what tactics they will employ in order not to be crushed, in order for a resistance to be successful. It's not ideological, and it's important not to be immature or childish about the choices that are made.
Yes, ma'am.
Question I ask you, how do the young people occupying Wall Street move into a system, a systemic system, that can be a best practice around the world of young people that are uprising and for change? How do we do that?
Can you repeat it?
The question was, how do young people occupy Wall Street, which I'm assuming you mean is an abstraction. It's a systemic change that is required. How do young people across the world join in creating this kind of a systemic change?
Right, as a best practice.
As a best practice.
In the world.
In the world.
For many, many years, the media in America has conspired to keep the people of the United States ignorant about what's going on in the rest of the world. There have been huge struggles, and there are enormous struggles going on across the world. I come from India, and I can tell you that the whole place is in ferment. And for us, this is already a practice. For us, it's already the fact that when 200,000 people gather in a village in India to protest a mining corporation, it's not even reported in the local papers. But when, 1,000 US citizens gather on Wall Street, it's almost a revolution. And that's important. It's important for us. I'm not trying to minimize it. I'm saying, this exchange of solidarities is already practiced. And I think that the movement here has to find ways of reaching out into other communities within the United States who perhaps are almost too marginalized to even join the occupation. There must be, I don't live here and I haven't traveled a lot in the United States, but when I do, sometimes I ask my friends, is there apartheid here? Where are the black folks? They're not around, you don't see them in restaurants or at meetings and so on. But all these solidarities have to be made, because that's how it will come, the practice will come. In India today, the poorest people in the world have stopped the richest mining corporations in their tracks because they're just putting their bodies on the line. In the US, I would love to see
a movement that stopped the transport of weapons, that actually locked out the weapons manufacturers, that did not allow the missiles to be moved onto ships to make war against other people to stimulate the economy here.
Yes, ma'am. The question is, what are your thoughts on the Anna Hazare movement in India these days?
I don't know whether how many people know about it, but it's a movement that captured the imagination of the Indian media, especially the corporate media and the Indian middle class, a movement against corruption. I guess the closest equivalent would be the Tea Party movement here. But essentially we are talking about making an unfair system work more smoothly and be less corrupt. So while it's easy for people to take a sort of global view of these people's uprisings in India and in the Middle East and in America and in the United States, you actually have to look at these things quite separately. And while that uprising was happening in India, there was not one single slogan against a single corporation. It was in fact sponsored by sponsored, I mean supported hugely 24 hours a day for weeks together by the corporate media. It was a movement very heavily supported by the right wing. And of course there were a lot of poor people who joined, you know, hoping that somehow it would reduce prices or bring them some kind of justice, because that was the hype. But all that fell away, actually. So, to put it, unsubtly, I found it rather repulsive.
Okay, I think we have time for just two more questions. Yes.
How is it possible for the Occupy movement to clear out this pipeline between us and the people, the comrades in the forest? How is it possible to show solidarity? And what would we gain by doing that?
Well, I don't think you need to clear out the pipeline. You know, I think that there was a time when I was among the people who thought that things like the World Social Forum that were happening, this effort to have real sort of logistical solidarity was very important. And then I found that all the best activists were just turning into travel agents, you know, booking people's tickets from Porto Alegre to Bombay and, mm-hmm. you know, organizing these meetings. The whole thing was becoming NGO-ized. I think it's important for everybody to fight their own battles with the same imagination that people are fighting within other places. But it's important for you to dismantle things here and allow people to fight their battles there while you understand each other. But I think one of the main things I would like to say is that people need to expose the connections between corporations, media, NGOs, all of this. You know, for example, in India, there's an iron ore mining company which is displacing thousands of indigenous people with its steel plants and its mines. The CEO of that company is a member of parliament. He's also the chairman of the National Flag Foundation because he won the right to fly the national flag on his house. They also have a global law school where they teach, you know, environmental law, and all the biggest sort of international lawyers come there as faculty. They're now going to start a global school of public policy. They also support a lot of cutting-edge artists working in stainless steel. They recently held a protest workshop where all the activists and poets and radical people came to recite their poetry and talk about protest. So you see, these people,
These corporations generate so much money that they can be the governor in the government, they can have the flag, they can have the media, they can be the resistance and the oppressors, they can be everybody. You know? It's like a Hindu mythological in which you can call the gods and the demons and everybody can be everybody. So these are the links that need to be broken. So that the media, for example, it's not that journalists are bad people or editors are evil, but just the way it's structured. Everything comes from corporate advertising. So how can you expect it to function otherwise? It's structurally built to perpetuate a system that is creating the problem. And can the imagination that created the problem solve it? I don't think so.